ce que tu es.
So there are two things I want to do today. One is talk about projects, so final projects for this class, and the other is to talk about dimension formulas, which is what these notes are. And I could easily spend two or three, the entire week on these notes, but also here I think what I'm going to do is probably just a summary today of the contents of what's here, and then on Wednesday we'll start with linear algebra. Okay, so first projects. And Dustin Moody emailed me a few hours ago and said that he wants to do connections between modular forms and partition theory. Does anybody else want to do that? Okay, good. So that's what Dustin's doing. Let's see, I suggested to Alex, I'm not sure how to do visualization, so draw graphs of everything you can think of to draw in this class. So, for example, today I'll talk about dimension formulas. You could draw graphs of these dimension formulas. See what you get. So that's another project. All right, what about you?
I was doing the elliptic refactoring.
Okay. So Robert Bradshaw, elliptic refactoring. By the way, in the notes today, I'm going to. Just to come, just in case you don't have a project, I have a project idea, which could be very interesting. Today I'm going to describe formulas for the following spaces of modular forms. So I'll give completely explicit formulas, including the dimensions of these spaces for any k greater than or equal to 2, and any n. Also, s, k, and epsilon. So I'll give formulas for all of these. There's one missing. Which natural space would you like to have a dimension formula for? That isn't on the board.
Is mk and epsilon in space?
Yes, mk. So, oddly enough, I don't know, it should be a lot easier once you know a dimension form for SK, it should be easy to find a dimension form for MK, since that's just, the dimension of MK and epsilon is equal to the dimension of SK and epsilon plus the dimension of EK, I's K and epsilon. But strangely enough, I've never seen anywhere in the literature a formula for the dimension of the epsilon, the Eisenstein series with conductor or Dirichlet character epsilon. So that is an annoying gap in my knowledge about dimension formulas. And currently in any software I've written, if you ask to compute that dimension, what it does is it enumerates all of the Dirichlet characters that give rise to an Eisenstein series that lives in this space, and it just counts how many it enumerated. That is, it finds pairs of Dirichlet characters chi and psi, so that I think, chi times psi inverse or something is equal to epsilon, and it also takes into account the conductor of chi and psi, and it's able to just use the algorithm for computing EK and epsilon to compute the dimension. But that's ridiculously slow compared to what should be possible. And also, you know the dimensions of Ek gamma 1 of n, Ek gamma 0 of n, and somehow this is just, it's just one of the pieces of what goes on there. So a good project would be to resolve this annoying fact and find a dimension formula for Ek and epsilon. But it might be hard, since I don't know how to do it. I haven't thought about it very much, but maybe it might be a better project for after the class as well, or for the summer workshop.
So I just wanted to point that out.
Okay, so those are three projects. What about you, Michael? Do you have an idea for a project?
Or someone see if I can implement something about Dirichlet characters,
sure.
Or maybe something else in Sage.
Okay. Any ideas what you want to fill the blank in? So possibly Dirichlet characters.
Yeah. Or anything that's accessible that needs implementing.
Okay. There's a lot of that. Okay. Andrew.
I don't have any ideas.
Okay, now do you have any ideas? Let's see, so what did you like the most so far in the course?
But I'd probably lean more towards some more like work with Sage or something as well.
Okay.
Maybe this is a different project?
Okay, we can talk about what specifically you want to do. Okay, James? Any thoughts? Okay. I have an idea for one thing you could do. So, you could compute the number of. So you know I gave a formula for the number of digits of the Bernoulli numbers V sub k, and it involved Stirling's formula. So it might be interesting to find a formula similar to that that's very efficiently computable for something about Bernoulli numbers with Dirichlet character, say quadratic Dirichlet character. I mean, it's something that's never been done as far as I know, but you could probably do it. It would be kind of fun because it would be new. Does that interest you? Okay, you can look at it. So, number of digits. It's a little trickier because you don't know the exact denominator, but look at the number of digits of P, K, epsilon, and epsilon is quadratic, say. So you don't have to have that. So, at least you could look into that and see what can be said. And got it. Might be your project. You're a busy guy. Okay, good. So, the project's good. I wish I could pull up my camera and take a picture, but I don't have a camera. All right, so on to dimension formulas. And everybody has a copy of the notes. There are some exercises at the back, which you can see here. And those will be due next Wednesday. Well, now I'm going to tell you what I know about dimension formulas. And yet again, unfortunately, I'm going to say essentially nothing about the actual details of how you prove these formulas are correct. Of course, I could spend 2 to 3 days just telling you what the formulas are, even given that I'm not giving you any of the details of the proofs. But to actually, again, to develop the background machinery needed to give careful proofs of any of the dimension formulas requires more things than what I want to assume in the class. Like you really need to know about the Riemann-Roch theorem, and Riemann-Hurwitz, you also have to have a good sense of how to think of modular forms as sections of a certain sheaf. Also, there's one problem, which is that some of the most important dimension formulas from a practical computational view, namely the one for SK and epsilon. Nobody's ever written down a proof that it published it. So it's kind of an annoying thing, but there is a nice dimension formula. Nobody doubts that it's right. The formula is given in the notes here, and there's a lot of discussion about how to actually compute it efficiently, which isn't at all obvious, which I learned from Kevin Buzzard. But actually writing down a proof that the dimension formula is right hasn't ever been done in the literature. And I asked one of the, so it's the formula for the dimension of a space is in a paper of Cohen and Osterle. So the other day when I, last year when I saw Cohen, Henri Cohen at Banff at a conference, I asked him what was the deal with, you know, this paper that gives a dimension formula and doesn't prove it. And he said, I proved that formula using these analytic methods that were sort of related to the ones that are that come in, that go into the proof of the Gross-Zagwe formula, and, you know, these sorts of analytic methods. And he didn't go into any detail about how he proved it. And he said it was many, 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 many pages long, but it was utterly trivial. And anyone who understood the methods that you would need to read the proof would be able to easily reproduce the proof, and so there's no point in putting it in there. Then he said, moreover, Cohen or Osterle also proved the same formula using entirely different methods. And the fact that there are two formulas, there are two proofs gave the same formulas, which also agree with numerical computation, because you can always just, you know, compare the formula of what you get when you compute the space using, say, modular symbols. The fact that everything agrees makes it so that you should believe it. And he also said in the case of Osterle that, you know, if you understood the methods he was using to write down the proofs, then you wouldn't need the proof. So, and I couldn't seem to convince him that that was a little weird, but that's the status as far as proofs go with this. So it's kind of annoying. The dimension formulas here, though, are much. You can find in Shimura's book. So you can find formulas for the dimensions of all these spaces in Shimura's classical book. I think it's an introduction to the arithmetic theory of automorphic forms. It's the standard, one of the standard references, or Miyake's book. So Miyake's book, Modular Forms, also has dimension formulas. So let me just tell you a little bit about what's going on. Let's see. And there are also some other spaces that it's interesting to compute their dimensions of, but I haven't defined them yet, so I need to do that. All right, first, turning to page 88, there's a huge formula which takes up essentially the second half of the page. So in the beginning of section 6.1, you can see that I've defined a whole bunch of integer, or a whole bunch of functions of an integer n that, let's see, the output is an integer except possibly, based on the formula, except possibly the last one, g0 of n. But in fact, g0 of n, this is an explicit formula for the genus of the curve x0 of n. Remember x0 of n from the beginning of the class? You take the upper half plane, you quotient out by the action of the group gamma 0 of n, and you get, if you add in some extra points, you get a compact Riemann surface. This is a completely explicit formula for the genus of that Riemann surface. So in fact, it's also an integer. And you can get this formula by considering the map from x0 of n to x0 of 1. x0 of 1, when n equals 1, is just the Riemann sphere, which has genus 0. So if you look at that map, you can figure out where the ramification is. That is where the number of points lying over a given point is less than what it is generically. If you put together information about the ramification and just if you know some geometry, you can use Riemann-Hurwitz to figure out exactly what the genus is. So, but it's not too hard, but it would take us too far afield. It's actually really easy to do this calculation. If you want the genus of the modular curve associated with gamma of n, where gamma of n is the kernel of the map from SL2z to SL2z mod n, the principal congruent subgroup. For this one, you have a corresponding modular curve which is denoted x of n, and it's particularly easy to figure out what the genus of this is. And I've written that up in detail in another book that I'm writing with Ken Revit. And also you can find it nicely described in Knapp's book. It's a very nice discussion there, Knapp's book on elliptic curves. So anyways, it's a geometry thing and it allows you to get the dimension of F, or the genus of x0 of n. So if you go down a little bit farther on the page, there's an explicit formula for the dimension of sk gamma 0 of n. And it's just basically a combination of all the things higher on the page with some floor functions, just some big arithmetic function. And it comes from geometry, from figuring out how dimensions of global sections of some sheaf vary as you vary various parameters. Also, there's an explicit formula for the dimension of the Eisenstein subspace. And this is a little bit easier to explain. It's the number of cusps when k is not 2, or the number of cusps minus 1 when k is equal to 2. And just to give you a sense that the Eisenstein space has something to do with the number of cusps, you have the following exact sequence. So all modular forms of weight k, for say, just to fix ideas, gamma 0 of n. If you have a modular form like that, you can evaluate it after, say, fixing representatives at each of the cusps. And it's defined at each of the cusps because it's holomorphic at the cusps. So when you do that, when you send a modular form to its tuple of values at fixed representatives for the elements of p1 of q modulo the action of gamma 0 of n, so we'll call them alpha 0 through alpha m, then you get an element of the finite dimensional vector space on the cusps. So you have a map from here to there, and its kernel is, by definition, the set of cusp forms. Because a cusp form is exactly a modular form that vanishes at each of the cusps. And mk gamma 0 of n is equal to the direct sum of the cuspidal subspace with the Eisenstein subspace. So this Eisenstein subspace, its dimension, whatever it is less than or equal to the number of cusps. Because the Eisenstein subspace injects, it's a subspace here, you have a direct sum decomposition like this, and Sk goes to zero. So the Eisenstein subspace, so it's a direct sum, which means that if anything in the Eisenstein subspace went to zero over here, then it would be in the cuspidal subspace and the sum wouldn't be direct. So this Eisenstein subspace, just from the sequence, is included inside of the free abelian group on the cusps. Or sorry, the finite dimensional complex vector space in the cusps. And this number C0 of n, which is just given by a formula at the top, which I won't explain, is the number of cusps. So this m, well, the dimension of this is C0 of n. Now, in the case of weight 2, this map is like the map that sends a function to its divisor. And in fact, the sum of the, if you take this vector, the sum of its entries is 0. Let's see, wait, what is? That's what happens in k equals 2, which means that this is not surjective, because that's a codimension 1, it lands inside of a codimension 1 subspace. I'm trying to think actually why that is. I cannot remember at the moment why that is. But when k equals 2, the sum of the values of the function of all the cusps is equal to 0. I didn't prepare this at all, and I don't at the moment remember a good argument for why that's the case. I don't know if you have anything to add at the top of your head, but in any case, when k equals 2, what happens is you end up, this image is a codimension 1 subspace. And that's why the dimension of the Eisenstein subspace is 1 less than the number of cusps. Now when k is greater than 2, and even, so that the space is non-zero, this map is surjective. So you really have an exact sequence like this. This is only if k is greater than 2 and even. And then the number of cusps is the same as the dimension of the Eisenstein subspace. So that's just a little explanation about the second part of the formula. In any case, this is a completely explicit formula for the dimension of S2 and more generally SK gamma 0 of n. And it's useful to have such a formula. For example, if you use modular symbols, as I explained before, to compute S2 gamma 0 of n, it would be nice as a double check to see that the result, the resulting space you get has the right dimension. Because if it doesn't, then you know there's some bug in your program. Here's a curious question which amazingly people wrote a paper about. If you fix, say, k equals 2, and look at what values does the function s2 gamma 0 of n take on as a function of n, you might think maybe every integer appears as the dimension of some space of modular forms. Shockingly, the answer is that not every integer appears. If you look at remark 6.1.5, way over on page 91, so just to give you a sense that these formulas, though they're completely elementary number theory formulas, there's still a little subtlety in them. Interestingly, if you look at all possible levels n and spaces of modular forms S2 gamma 0 of n, then these guys, Janosz Cherik, Joe Weatherall, and Mike Sieve, prove that 150 is not the dimension of any space of modular forms of weight 2 and level n, no matter what n you choose. And then they actually show there's infinite sequence of dimensions that do not occur. So, and in fact, it's, I guess, a density 1 set. So, yeah, if you choose an integer, the probability is 0 that it's the dimension of a space of modular forms. So, by the way, I went to grad school with these guys, all three of them, and I guess they all, well, none of them are in. Joe and Mike work for the government, and Janosz works for a bank or something. Or he works for one of those places that makes a lot of money on Wall Street. So he's, I think, the richest of my people in my class. Yeah, Janosz started at the same time as me. He was a student of Rivet, and Joe Weatherall started a little earlier than dropped out and created those kiosks in the airport that give you information about where you are. And then he went back to grad school and got his PhD with Aug. And Mike Z was a Leinster student who started a year or two before me. So they're all contemporaries. Okay, so that's the story for gamma 0 of n. There's explicit formulas. If you want to see what the values are like, there's a table on the top of page 89, which just has for a bunch of values of n, such as next year, when the book will be published, S2 gamma 0 of n, the dimension is 221. So if you look at weight 2 modular forms of level 2007, there's a basis with 221 of them. And you can see it gets really big if you consider, say, weight 24, it's already 6,206. And you know, there's another example, 100,000, you can see what the different dimensions are. Okay, so that's gamma 0. And I think I'll skip ahead for the moment to gamma 1. This is the beginning of section 6.2. On page 92, you'll see a page that looks almost exactly the same as the page for gamma 0. And in fact, it is very, very similar. And it's just the formulas for these dimensions, or the dimensions of these spaces. So really, you derive them in a similar way, and the results are very similar. So it's not a big surprise about how this works. I have a to-do there. If anybody wants to do that, that would be nice. It's probably even pretty easy. Okay, so that's all I'll say about gamma 1, except it's entertaining to look at the table on page 93. So if you flip over, you'll see a table. It's, except for the fact I left 2004 there. It's exactly the same input as the table that I showed you before. Notice the numbers are much, much, much larger, though. So they're really, really, really big in comparison to the numbers from before. Okay, so that's gamma 0 and gamma 1. And Let's see, now let's look at section 6.3, which is modular forms with character. And this is the one for which no proof is written down in the literature, but these are really, for applications, probably the most important, or at least they turn out to be extremely useful in applications. Already you have a big advantage over many people just by me telling you there exist formulas in this case. I spent many years actually not knowing that anyone had ever written down any formulas for the dimensions when there's a character, and I even derived a formula myself based on the trace formula, which is in fact how Oesterle did this, but the formula I derived myself was far, far less efficient to compute because I didn't understand how to simplify the trace formula enough than the one that's given here. The one given here, especially with the algorithmic remarks that I worked out with Kevin, Buzzard is very, very efficient. And it's in Sager's type dimension cusp forms underscore epsilon, and you get very, very quickly you can compute these spaces. So let me tell you about this. So the goal is to compute. Maybe kind of a funny formula, actually. Wait a minute. So it might be that this question about the dimension of the Eisenstein subspace, maybe you can just cleverly use how this formula is written to figure out what the dimension of the Eisenstein subspace is as well. Maybe we can figure that out right now. In any case, let me tell you what the formula is that Kellner and Oesterle derived. So this is at the bottom of page 93 in the notes. So you fix any integer at all, and you fix it in k, and you fix an integer n and an epsilon, and you assume that epsilon at minus 1 is minus 1 to the k. Otherwise, all the spaces would have dimension 0. You've seen this sort of thing over and over again. By the way, this assumption that k is an integer, their formulas also have some conclusions in the case when k is a half integer. I haven't talked at all about half integer modular forms. There's a whole theory for them, and these dimension formulas do give you information in that case as well. And I don't discuss that much in here. And here's the formula they prove. So they tell you that, it's sort of funny, but the dimension of Sk n epsilon minus the dimension of m 2 minus k n epsilon. So notice that if k is, say, bigger than or equal to 2, this is just 0. This is equal to something completely explicit, k minus 1 over 12 mu 0 of n minus a half. Okay, so mu 0, this was a very simple arithmetic function that appeared in the formula for the dimension of x of s2 gamma 0 of n. It's actually just equal to the index of gamma 0 of n and SL2z. It's just an explicit, it's just that function. So that's what mu 0 of n is. And so I'll tell you the rest of the formula. Minus 1 half product over p dividing n, lambda of p n, p sub p of c. So this lambda is a completely explicit thing, which is hard to compute if you just look at the... Actually, no, that's actually easy to compute. It's just a simple function of p and some other things. So some explicit thing that is described on the next page, plus gamma 4 of k times some x in a 4 of n. This is some special set, epsilon of x, plus gamma 3 of k sum over x in a 3 of n epsilon of x. Okay, and these a 4 and a 3 are elements in z mod nz that have a certain property. So for example, a 4 of n, these are the elements of z mod nz whose square is minus 1. And A3 is something similar, but where there are elements of Z mod NZ that are cubic of unity. And these gamma 3 and gamma 4, they're explicit rational numbers that depend on the congruence class of k modulo either 3 or 4. And this formula, if you ever end up working with trace formulas, this formula kind of has a similar feeling to the trace formula, except it's much simpler. But it does sort of have a similar thing. But in any case, the key thing is, and the exact definition of these other functions is given on the second page, everything on the right-hand side is explicitly computable without knowing about modular forms or modular symbols. And you can, in fact, compute each of these things very efficiently using a not-so-obvious algorithm that's described for the last couple of pages of the handout that I described in proven detail here. But in any case, you have a completely explicit formula for the difference of these two dimensions. And since you know that the dimension of m sub k, you know, anything, is 0 for k less than or equal to 0, this allows you to compute the dimension of sk and epsilon. Okay. Now, I'm curious, so curious that I can't wait another second. Can you use this formula to compute the dimension of the Eisenstein subspace for a given level and weight and character? Just curious. Maybe you can cleverly use it, because if you plug in a negative, yeah, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? It's completely obvious. Just plug in a negative value for k, then this becomes positive. This is 0, and you can compute all of this stuff. So in fact, you get the whole dimension of m whatever here. And once you have that, use the formula with the positive value of k to get this dimension and subtract the two, and you'll get the Eisenstein subspace. Actually, you can compute the Eisenstein subspace, the dimension of the Eisenstein subspace using this formula. We have to apply it twice. And I never realized that. But does that make any sense to you?
The formula is valid for negative k.
Yes, absolutely. For sure. Positive or negative. Any integer k. Yeah, it works for any integer. Basically, you have a gadget that will give you the dimension, the difference of these two dimensions for any integer k, positive or negative. And once you have that, you can compute this one, whatever k is greater than or equal to 2. You get this one. And whenever k is less than 2, actually, I guess a problem would be 1. Well, actually, an amusing thing here is that when you set k equal to 1, you get the dimension of the cusforms of weight 1 minus the dimension of modular forms of weight 1. And I remember once when I was a grad student, I was trying to implement every dimension formula, and I came across Bruce Caskell's code for computing dimensions of spaces, and he had like everything except, I mean, except for the character stuff, he didn't have anything, but he didn't have weight 1. So I wanted to finish his program, and he had, you know, like a function that was supposed to do this, and he had a comment, finish this case. And so he didn't have that one filled in. So then I asked Kevin and other people, what is a dimension formula for this? And actually, sorry, it should be gamma 1. For gamma 0, you just get, for any odd weight, and for gamma 0, you just get 0. But for gamma 1, maybe you'll get something really interesting. And there really are forms of weight 1 and some level. So I asked Kevin, he said it was an incredibly hard problem to compute the dimension of this space for any integer n at all. And that the only way he knew to do it was to use like some extremely deep results of, I guess, Langlands and other people about how eigenforms, you actually need two ways to do it, sorry. I should step back for a second. There is a way to compute this by the following method that I think was originated by Tate. Take this space, which you don't know, and just take some modular form that you know completely explicitly, just for simplicity, let's say a weight 2 modular form, F, which you know completely explicitly. If you take this space and multiply each element by F, you'll get a subspace of some space of modular forms of weight 1 plus the weight of F. So you, in other words, you can embed by multiplication by some modular form F the space of weight 1 forms in some space of forms of higher weight.
it's in depth via a form G in here, maps to G times our specific fixed F. You can embed inside of S 1 plus the weight of F. Gamma 1 of the level might be bigger if F has level bigger than 1. So maybe N times the level of F. And interestingly, if you do this in enough different ways, you can figure out exactly what the image of this is inside of here. And so Tate invented this. It's described in a lot of detail in two places. Springer Lecture Notes 1585. They use this to verify a conjecture of Artin on modularity of icosahedral Gal representations in a number of cases, in 7 cases. And what they do is they just embed this space in here, and then somehow by embedding it in different ways, they can divide, and you end up getting Q expansion basis for this. It's very, very hard, though, and takes a lot of work, but you can do it. And the result would eventually, you have to compute very hard just to get the answer even for n pretty small, but you can eventually do it, and the result will give you a basis for the space since you'll know its dimension. So that's one way that you can actually compute the dimension. And this is this whole idea of embedding a space that you can't directly compute inside of a space you can compute using higher weight modular symbols is developed in a lot more detail in a PhD thesis of Basmaji from 1996. So he also has this idea. This guy worked with Fry, and Fry was the editor for this book, but Basmaji. So he also uses this idea of embedding to compute spaces of half integral weight modular forms. So it's just an aside, it's not really in the thrust of this talk or chapter. But I just wanted to mention that you can compute these, but they're really, really hard to compute. Another way to compute this is to use the correspondence between odd continuous representations of the Galois group of Q bar over Q to GL2C and modular forms of weight 1. So there's a connection between the two. You can figure out what all of the all representations of a given form or the given structure like this are. You can use that to figure out what all, at least find the dimension of this space. So one of the things Kevin did was to explicitly compute this space for all n up to, I think, 122, and then on the other hand, to figure out what all the Galois representations were like this, possibly consulting tables that enumerate all Galois extensions up to some with some bounded conditions, and he ended up getting the same numbers. But these are very, very hard. So I asked him about formulas. He said, I don't know any formulas for this. So I wasn't able to fill in, unfortunately, I wasn't able to fill in Bruce Cascell's code and clean up the one missing case. So this one's really, really, really hard, unfortunately. But these are not so bad. Sk and epsilon minus this, you can compute this difference using this formula. And computing this formula, I could talk about for an entire lecture, but I won't. It's in Sage and in Magma. And as I just noticed in front of you, you can compute the dimension of the Eisenstein subspace as well, simply by using this formula, but with a negative value of k. And maybe you should implement that for your project, because it's not implemented. But what is implemented, I think, is computing this whole chunk. So it would be easy to implement computing the Eisenstein subspace, because I can compute the difference. Okay, so let's see, what else shall I tell you? Yes, please.
I don't know if you've introduced W operators.
I haven't, but that might be a good time.
Well, for S2, gamma 0, and you decompose it by these involutions. Mm-hmm. Are the formulas for the dimensions?
Ooh, that's really hard, I think. You think there would be a nice formula, because after all, it is just the genus of a curve. But I don't know when.
So, of course, the prime factorization of n will give you the number of these
Yeah, that's right. So Ralph's pointing out that the modular curve x0n for any prime q that exactly divides n, so this is our prime power, sorry, it's a prime power. There's an associated involution WQ called an Atkin-Lehner involution of this curve, and that induces an involution of S2 gamma 0 n. And these involutions of S2 gamma 0 n, they all commute, and hence you can use them to break up S2 gamma 0 n as a direct sum of eigenspaces where you choose what you want the signs to be for all of these involutions, and you have the corresponding eigenspace. So you can multiply this all together. What you get is called the Atkin-Lehner operator Wn. And I think if you view x out of n as a quotient of the upper half plane, this Wn is just induced by z goes to minus 1 over nz, I think, on the upper half plane. Is that right? That's right. So this is a map from the upper half plane to the upper half plane. Notice that if you take a number in the upper half plane and invert it, you get something in the lower half plane, and if you take a negative, it gets you back up in the upper half plane. So this is a map. This is actually an involution. This induces an involution of x0 of n. So you can quotient out by that, and you get something called x0 of n plus quotient of x0 of n. And basically, Rolf's asking if there's a formula for the dimension or the genus of this, and I don't know. I'm pretty sure there isn't an easy formula. It would be very helpful, but if there is one, I'm completely unaware of it. And hence, if anyone could tell me, I'd be happy to hear about it. Okay. Any other comments? You might want to add.
So I guess then there's no formula for the dimensions of the simple abelian varieties.
Yeah, that would be nice to hear. Yeah. So here's an obvious question. There's a ton of questions along the following lines. So I told you about dimensions for the whole space of modular forms. You give a k and an n and an epsilon or no epsilon at all, and there's an explicit formula that for either s or m or e that gives you the dimension of that space. That's really nice. We're in good shape there. Everything's pretty good. But what about, well, how much do you know? So remember, I told you that you can compute S2 gamma 0 n using modular symbols. You can get a basis of Q expansions and modular forms for this space. And there's an action of Heck operators on it. And the Heck operators, they all commute with one another. And therefore, this space is simultaneously, well, there's a basis for this space such that every element of T acts diagonally on there. Except possibly there's one problem with that. T sub P is with P dividing a level, that's not quite true. But let's just take what's called the anemic Heck algebra so that what I say is true. You take T prime, this is the so-called anemic Heck algebra, and it's just Z adjoining all the Heck operators, T sub N, with N co-prime to the level. So as far as I know, Ken Rivet is the only one that calls it the anemic Heck algebra, but it seems to be a good name for it. Maybe we could call it the skinny Heck algebra. We could call this the fat Heck algebra and spell it with a P. Probably shouldn't. Anemic Heck algebra. So this one, every single one of these Heck operators is diagonalizable. It's just a problem. When n does divide the level or isn't co-prime to the level, it's possible for that Heck operator to not be diagonalizable at all. And in fact, usually it isn't. If you have a prime whose cube divides a level, then T sub dot prime is almost always not diagonalizable. In any case, if you consider this subring of the Heck algebra, then every element here is diagonalizable. They all commute with each other as they act on S2 gamma 0 of n, and hence they can be simultaneously diagonalized. And then you can choose a basis of normalized eigenforms for all of these Heck operators. Say F0, F1, and so on. And you can group them. Because this space has a basis defined over Q, that is to say, it has a basis for which the Q expansions have coefficients and irrational numbers, you can group the eigenvectors you can group them in Galois conjugacy classes. So they look like Q plus maybe A2, Q squared, and so on. And then the next one's Q plus, and then you just put a Galois conjugate of A2 here. Or by Galois conjugate, I mean a Galois group of Q bar over Q is acting on these things. So you can group them up into Galois orbits. The sizes of the Galois orbits are the same as the dimensions of the simple submodules of S2 gamma 0 n as a module over T prime, but where you have to be careful. There's some technical thing I'm sort of leaving out. But in any case, it's extremely interesting to know what the dimension, the number, the size of the Galois orbits are, or what's completely equivalent to know what the degrees of the fields are like that are generated by all of the Fourier coefficients of each of these normalized eigenforms. Or, what's more, which is, this is the following, it's much easier to understand, and also essentially equivalent to everything I'm saying. Take a specific Hecke operator, acting on S2 gamma 0 of n, consider its characteristic polynomial, I'll finish in 30 seconds, factor it as a product of irreducible polynomials. Then what are the dimensions of the factors that appear? Well, generically, except for some interesting examples, you get a bunch of numbers. Figuring out what the dimensions of those factors are is really, really subtle. And here's a typical, very difficult question. How many, are there infinitely many, let's see, how to say this? Are there infinitely many, what can you say about the number of factors that have coefficients all in Z, that is, correspond to elliptic curves as a function of n? Now, if you give an n, are there any elliptic curves at all of conductor n? It's completely equivalent to one of these eigenforms having coefficients in Q. And it's a very difficult problem. But I've actually seen specific n, which there are thousands of different eigenforms, which every single one had coefficients in Q. So you can get really, really big. In any case, there's not really too much more for me to say. Just to tell you what I've omitted, I didn't talk at all about new forms and old forms and dimension formulas for new subspaces, and they're in here. And I think they're so important, I will say something about that at the beginning next time. And this thing about the dimensions of the factors probably is very confusing because I didn't prepare this before I explained it to you. But you'll see a lot of explicit examples, especially in the next part of the course, namely the linear algebra part, which is all about finding these eigenvectors explicitly. So really, the rest of the week is going to be about making this a lot clearer. So I apologize if this was incredibly confusing, but it only took you 3 minutes. Okay, so I'll see you all on Wednesday, and I'll say a little bit about new forms, old forms, and I'll start with linear algebra.